Everyone. All the people spoke well of Jesus and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. That's Luke 4:22. All the people in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove Jesus out of town and led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so that they might hurl him off a cliff. That's Luke 4:28 through 29. I wonder at what point Jesus realized his fellow congregants were not quite getting what it was he was trying to say to them. Have you ever had one of those moments when you shared news with someone and they so misunderstood the point that they took from it the exact opposite of what you had intended? My friends, we are going to be restructuring the company, the boss says. And the naive employee sitting in the front row of the conference room begins clapping and hooting his approval, not realizing that restructuring isn't a code for giving you all a raise, but rather giving you all the boot. Have you ever had a moment like that? Kids, Mom and I have just reserved a beach house for a weekend trip. And the children immediately jump up and clap and shout their approval, not for one moment realizing that I meant the trip is just for Lisa and me. Have you ever been part of a moment like that? Because if so, you are in the perfect position to understand the rather strange moment we receive from Luke 4 today. Jesus has just finished reading from the scroll of Isaiah, declaring his vision for ministry to his fellow Nazarenes. And everyone gathered in that synagogue begins applauding and hollering their approval. And honestly, why shouldn't they? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, Jesus has said, because God anointed me to bring good news to the poor, proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of Jubilee. Is this not very good news? And of course, it is. The year of Jubilee, or the year of the Lord's favor, as some versions translate it, is, according to the book of Leviticus, the year when servants are released from servitude, which is to say, those who are locked in contracts they can't get out of, deals they hate but have no power to change, are now freed from them. In the year of Jubilee, all debts are entirely forgiven. Forget about those student loans. Don't worry anymore about that underwater mortgage. Cut up that credit card and think of it no more. And in the year of Jubilee, everyone receives back their rightful belongings, not simply one's possession and home, though that is part of it, but also one's freedom and security and dignity that rightly belong to them. This is, by any measure, great, good news, the year of Jubilee, which is why when Jesus said it, all the people spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. And yet, if all this good news is being shared, if everyone in the entire synagogue is so excited about the gracious mercy Jesus has come to bring, then why, just six verses later, does Luke tell us all the people in the synagogue were filled with rage and immediately got up, drove him out of town, led him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built, and tried to hurl him off a cliff? What has happened here? They're like the employee who thought he was getting a raise, only to discover he's actually getting fired. They're like the children who thought they were going to the beach for the weekend, only to find out that mom and dad are actually leaving them behind at home. Only in the case of these Nazarenes, it's not nearly as clear as it would be for that employee or those children. just what it is they have misunderstood. Is this not the year of Jubilee Jesus is proclaiming? Is this not the promised moment we have all been waiting for? Is this not, dare we believe, the Messiah who has come? And yes, as it turns out, all of this is in fact true. So what is the issue here? How have we gone from all spoke well of him and were amazed to all were filled with murderous rage in the span of just 6 verses? Well, at some point in his sermon, Jesus begins to realize that his audience is not really hearing what it is that he is saying. Like this: my wife, after working in the yard all day long, comes into the house at dinner time to find me in sweatpants, lounging on the couch, munching on snacks, and watching yet another football game, and says to me, "I'm so glad that you can sit around cozy and comfortable all afternoon while I mow the lawn, trim the hedges, and rake up all the leaves." And when I reply, "Why, thank you, honey, me too," she realizes, as any sensible human would, I'm not really hearing what it is she is actually saying. I have missed the obvious sarcasm in this case, and therefore missed the entire message. Of course, in the case of Jesus' sermon, it's not the sarcasm that they have missed, but something far more significant. Something that is so central to Jesus' entire message, he simply cannot leave it as is. Like my wife, who clarifies her sarcastic intent with a shake of her head and a sigh, helping me suddenly realize what she is really saying, Jesus clarifies his intent by telling them 2 stories. His own creative version of the disapproving head nod and sorrowful sigh. The first story from 1 Kings 17 tells about the prophet Elijah and how he helped feed a woman from Zarephath in Sidon, that is, a Canaanite woman. The second story from 2 Kings 5 tells about Elijah's successor, Elisha, and how he helped heal a Syrian soldier. 2 of the more famous prophets in Jewish history and 2 of the more famous moments from their ministries. And as with my wife's disapproving sigh, it is immediately effective on Jesus' audience, leaving us to ask ourselves, particularly since Luke leaves it somewhat implicit, why? Just what is it that these stories are suggesting that upsets the congregation so much? Why should these stories from their own scriptures trouble them so deeply with regard to the year of Jubilee? Well, to help us see what is at stake here, I'd like to quote to you a set of reflections from New Testament scholar Richard Hayes. Hayes, after a long and distinguished and frankly world-renowned career, wrote these words in the final book he published before his passing in early January of 2025. Reflecting on Luke 4, our passage this week, Hayes sets the scene by suggesting that within the context of Luke's story, this sermon from Luke 4, Jesus' Jubilee sermon, is in fact a bombshell, which, of course, is precisely what it becomes. The people of Nazareth, Hayes writes, are clearly excited by Jesus' message. The year of the Lord's favor, the year of Jubilee, has finally arrived. And they say to themselves, "Thank God. Thank God that the time has come at last for us to be liberated. God is going to drive out our enemies, and God is going to make Israel great again. And this, Hayes writes, is the most welcome message for the people of that synagogue. For as Luke reports, all the people spoke well of him and were amazed at the words of grace that came from his mouth, Luke 4:22. All spoke well of him. That is, until Jesus continued preaching and ruined it all for everyone. Jesus, Hayes writes, explains to the people of his hometown, his fellow citizens, that he has a different vision of what the message from Isaiah is actually all about. Which is to say, Jesus offers them a wider understanding, as Hayes puts it, of Isaiah's message than the typical interpretation of Isaiah held by his fellow townspeople. And to clarify just how wide of an interpretation Jesus has, he tells them two stories from Scripture, as we heard just a moment ago, in which non-Jewish outsiders, one from the region of Sidon, another from Syria, receive God's mercy. Cue the aforementioned bombshell. For the talk of this absolutely crazy, wide mercy was the precise opposite, it turns out, of what the people of that town wanted to hear. Their hope, Hayes clarifies, was all about a national restoration, and therefore they simply have no place in their religion or politics for the notion of God's effusive mercy being lavished upon foreigners. And they are particularly incensed to hear Jesus citing stories from their very own scriptures to defend such a seemingly unpatriotic idea. In fact, they weren't merely surprised or disappointed at the way Jesus was expanding the wideness of God's mercy. They were, in fact, filled with rage. So furious, in fact, that they got up, drove him out of town, led him to the brow of a hill that they might hurl him from a cliff. Luke 4:28 and 29. For this interpretation of Isaiah simply could not be what God had really intended for God's chosen people. But as Luke tells the story, Hayes concludes, from the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, Jesus had interpreted Isaiah's prophetic message and his very own work to signify not only the restoration of Israel, but the expanse of God's grace and mercy to encompass even foreigners and foreign nations and every other outcast Jesus ever encountered. These reflections, by the way, if you're interested, can be found in Richard Hayes' book, written with his son Christopher Hayes, chair of Old Testament at Fuller Theological Seminary, in a book titled The Widening of God's Mercy. What was it that moved the people of Nazareth from delighted and amazed to filled with rage? It was, according to Luke, a disagreement over God's mercy and just what it means for a people to be great. For the citizens of Nazareth, the greatness of God and God's people had everything to do with their national identity. Their belief, after years of frustration, was that the chosen one would eventually come and, as Hayes put it, make Israel great again. Their hope, in other words, was that God's chosen leader would finally rout their enemies once and for all, putting them back on top where true greatness was certainly to be found. But what they failed to see, as Jesus immediately recognizes, is that what really makes them great, at least according to God, is not their own power and strength, but their capacity for an ever-widening mercy. And mercy, Jesus teaches, simply knows no boundaries. The people of Nazareth had falsely presumed that greatness had to do with their own nationalistic ideals. But God, as Jesus demonstrates from their very own scriptures, had other ideas. In fact, God, in the voice of Jesus, names their nationalist ambitions as idolatry. For according to Jesus, the greatness of God and God's people comes in the form of an ever-widening mercy shown to an ever-widening swath of humanity. Jesus' fundamental proclamation from the very beginning is that God's favor and mercy are a favor and mercy for all. And only by offering them to all can we ever find greatness again. Of course, the Nazarenes were having none of this. And near the end of Luke's passage, they tried to hurl him off a cliff for saying so. But thankfully, our story doesn't actually end there. Luke's final line says this: despite their murderous plot, Jesus passed right through the midst of them and went on his way. There will, no doubt, always be Nazarenes in this world. And we will, no doubt, continue to struggle with the temptation they present. The temptation to grasp at greatness by grasping at God's favor exclusively for ourselves. Even if it means we have to throw Jesus and his message off the nearest cliff to do so. But Luke's hopeful conclusion is that Nazarenes do not ultimately succeed. Christ will yet pass through the midst of them and go on his way. And I pray that as he does, we will have the courage of our faith to follow and to say to one another, great is God's mercy and grace for all. Amen.